It's on and I'll never die. 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 That's it for the Wrecking Hours this week. That was the Pharaohs doing Blue Egypt. Going to leave you with the Necromantics doing Brain Error. Hopefully, we did get to most of the surf requests and just tons and tons of requests today, so we're going to get to more next week when you come back to hear another edition of the Wrecking Hours from 4 to 6. Next up is the Monday Talk Forum. Today, we have the Sierra Club Radio and also Planetary Radio talking about drilling on Mars. That is the Monday Talk Forum happening right after this.
All right, I've gone through all the tracks. Just move through the beats. Do your thing.
All right, everyone, let's hear it for West High's own Brooke Turner, a.k.a. DJ Hook.
Scratching up my first school dance takes confidence. So getting into college, I've got what it takes. So do you.
Visit knowhowtogo.org to learn what you should be doing right now to prepare for college. Start taking the steps at knowhowtogo.org. Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation, and the Ad Council.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Reverend Yearwood, president of the Hip Hop Caucus, about why he's opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. And Sierra Club executive director Michael Bruhn will talk with us about the president's recent nominations. Marianne Hitt from the Beyond Coal campaign will join us as well to talk with us about a recent milestone they've had and why clean energy is on the rise. We're here now with Reverend Yearwood, minister, community activist, and president of the Hip Hop Caucus. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we're so thrilled you could join us today. I wanted to start by having you tell our listeners a little bit more about your organization, the Hip Hop Caucus.
Most definitely. So the Hip Hop Caucus was created in 2004 to ensure young people of color and the hip hop community have a sustainable year-round national presence embodying the cultural values of hip-hop and the experiences of its supporters in matters concerning political engagement, environmental justice, and human rights. Caucus is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and where we use hip-hop as the common ground to reach a new generation of young urban adults to bridge the gap with civil rights identification in the 21st century, and collective action for change, and evolving, I would say, outreach platform and relevant programs are used to educate and frame civil rights for today's society in relatable terms specific for low-income urban communities, such as the negative impact of climate change and pollution on health and safety, access to quality education, voting rights and disenfranchisement, healthy and affordable food options, ongoing violence in neighborhoods, and equal employment opportunities in a green economy. The Hip-Hop Caucus teaches the importance of active participation in and access to elections and policymaking to change negative conditions and provides the structure and resources needed to create and integrate and sustain productive and healthy lifestyles. I'm very honored to be the president of this wonderful organization because the Hip Hop Caucus strengthens the democratic process by connecting people to the issues.
What are some of the specific accomplishments that you're most proud of?
You know, there are many with this organization. I mean, they range from Make Hip Hop Not War, when we were organizing against the war in Iraq, issues from Green the City and Green the Block, where we organize young people regarding opportunities in the green economy, and also Green the City, which we brought mayors to Washington, D.C. We organized countless bus tours, and we're probably most known, if I said this last, for what helped create us, which was probably the Vote or Die campaign, getting out the vote, and then Took My Vote campaign, which is very powerful. We did that in 2008 with T.I. And also in 2012 with 2 Chainz. And we really worked with those two artists because they were both ex-felons. And getting felons re-enfranchised into the process is very important to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've recently been very involved in protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, which would bring the dirtiest oil on Earth through the U.S. to be shipped overseas. And you mentioned climate change when you talked about some of the issues that Hip Hop Caucus cares about. I'm wondering why you got involved in this specific fight and what's so important about the pipeline.
Well, the pipeline is very important. I mean, I think that the great thing about the Hip Hop Caucus and the work that we're doing is that we try to, you know, we believe justice everywhere is very important. Mm-hmm. I think Dr. King said the best, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so clearly we have been involved with the Pacific relations with the negative impacts of climate change and pollution, particularly on urban communities. We've been doing that since Katrina. I mean, Katrina was a major piece of work for us. Probably one of the most important things that we worked on from the very inception. It's probably the thing that I think catapulted the Hip Hop Caucus as an organization. And I think since that time, and me being also from Louisiana, sometimes we used to call Louisiana, we still do, and sometimes we call it Cancer Alley because there's so many people who have cancer and dealing with that effect. And so we began to deal with the issue of the environment and what that means, particularly as we saw what it means to poor people and poor people in this country, that they are the most affected to the adverse from asthma and cancer to heat stroke for our seniors. So I think that, you know, we've been involved and we recognize that it's not just about environmental justice or just about the green economy, but it's clearly about climate change. That's where the rubber meets the road, is what we would say, where you put the cheese on the crackers. Climate change is where we have to make that difference, for not only for us, but for future generations. And so I think that being the case, knowing what scientists have said, my good friend Jim Hansen from NASA and from Columbia University and other scientists who have said that, listen, the Keystone XL pipeline project, if those permits are given to bring those dirty tar sand oil down that pipeline and then shipped off, that would be, in essence, a game over. And so, you know, we recognize that if you're going to fight for any other issue, if it's education, if it's gun violence, if it's health care, if we lose the planet, we lose it all. So that is why we have not only invested ourselves, but put ourselves at the forefront using clearly our culture and how we do things to help really bring awareness to what we feel would be a disastrous decision to affirm and allow for the Keystone XL pipeline.
You spoke recently at the big climate change rally in D.C., and you said that the environmental movement didn't have enough love and that this time we're going to change that. Can you explain what you meant and where do we go from here to get there?
Well, I think in general, I don't think it's just the environmental movement. I think that the progressive movement in mm-hmm. general has to move from simply a macro approach, the movement, mm-hmm. Big M, to a micro, a movement, small M, dealing with individuals in the movement. And I think that we have to, but it's very important for us to be concerned about our organizations and our institutions that help propel. And, you know, as you know, that rally was 350 and Sierra Club and Hip Hop Caucus leading the way. I think it's also important not to forget about the individuals, those who came on buses, those who came from Canada, those who came from Nebraska, those who drove for 16, 24, 20 hours just to get there, just standing in the cold in some cases, for 3 and 4 hours in the march around the White House. I think we can't forget about those stories, and I think we can't forget about what we're doing. And I think it's love that will propel us, not only for those here today, but I think it's love that will propel us to do whatever it takes to protect future generations. It truly is that love. And I think that's the one thing, nothing that we don't have that love. I mean, clearly people have a concern and they want to fight for the cause. I think it's just a little deeper. I think it's just a love that means that, you know, you will, what can I do for my neighbor kind of love, and that you will put yourself on the line kind of love. And I think that we saw that. I think that recently we saw with Sierra Club for the first time allowing and going forth into disobedience, putting aside, you know, bylaws and rules that, you know, we'll probably find a time, but I felt they recognize now that they must go further. Hip Hop Caucus, coming out of its piece of being in hip hop and culture and coming into areas that are very important to the community as a whole. I think that's the thing. I think getting out of one's box. And I think as a progressive movement, I think that sometimes our movement can be siloed. Meaning that we only see the problem only through our prism. You know, we might only see it through environment. We might only see it through education. We might only see it through healthcare. We might only see it through criminal justice. But I think that we are now beginning to break those down. And I think also in regards to just us as a people, I think sometimes we've been siloed, unfortunately, as a progressive movement, even by color, where you might have black or white or brown or yellow, almost divided. Sometimes the blacks want to be with criminal justice. Sometimes brown would be with immigration. White might be with just with climate, with the environment or with peace movements and so forth and so on. But I think what we saw on February 17th, you saw the beginning of the breakdown. You saw black, you saw white, you saw brown, you saw yellow, you saw red, male, female, straight, gay, theist, atheist, coming together fighting for humanity. And I think that is when I begin this. When we can do more of that, nothing can stop us. I think once we come together and we let the world know, or the powers that be know, that they know that nothing will stop us when we come together as one people.
What inspires you and keeps you going on a daily basis? What motivates you when so much of this work can feel like an uphill battle?
Well, you know, I take a lot in history before getting into this work. You know, I am a reverend. Yeah, I ask that all the time. Are you a real reverend? I did go to seminary. I actually was studying to be a biblical archaeologist, one of the most rare things. And so I take a lot in history and the struggles. And so I take that every single time that people who have organized together, in essence, organized people, has always beat organized money throughout history. Slavery, women's rights, gay and lesbian rights, other rights in this country. We have seen that when we have come together, that we have overcome some most daunting of tasks or obstacles in our way. And so that is inspiring, one, because you can look back and you can see those from Abby Hoffman to a Dr. King to a Susan B. Anthony to a Fannie Lou Hamer. And you can look back and you can see what they have done. I think the other thing is that for us in this generation, I think that what inspires me too is that I recognize by looking at that most of them throughout the 20th century and the 19th century were fighting for equality. And that is inspiring, but also I think that was daunting for our generation, those of us in the 21st century, that we're literally fighting for existence, that we're fighting something a little different, that we're now fighting something that if we fail, which we can't fail, but if we allow to go forward, that clearly humanity suffers and that humanity begins to pay the ultimate price of its inaction. So I think that clearly is inspiring when you think of it that way, that you're fighting for literally the existence of humanity. I mean, if that doesn't get you going, then I don't know what else is going to get you moving there. But that definitely helps me when I, like everybody else, get tired and like everybody else get frustrated. And when you see decisions that are made from different entities in the government that clearly aren't following what it is, you're discouraged. Again, looking at history, you can look at the Dred Scott decision, which was by the Supreme Court, and they said that, listen, no person of color, African or black, free or slave, was could be considered a citizen in this country. And so when you look at that and we can overcome that, then you can see that, listen, we've overcome things in the past that have been horrible, and I know together that we will overcome our destruction or our past in regards to climate change.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Reverend Yearwood, president of the Hip Hop Caucus. We're here now with Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club. Welcome.
Hi, Riley.
So we wanted to talk with you because there have been some interesting headlines this week about new appointments that the president has made. I wanted to start just by getting your assessment of what you think about the job that Lisa Jackson did leading the EPA before we talk about some of the new appointments.
Well, we thought that Lisa did a great job. I mean, certainly there were lots of issues. And part of the role of being the Sierra Club is that we're even taking people like Lisa Jackson into court sometimes to push them to go as far as they can. But if you rank her among other EPA administrators since the EPA was created 40 years ago, she'd probably come out on top. What we're looking for in her replacement, Gina McCarthy, is someone to continue the legacy that she left behind, that Lisa left behind, and to make sure that we are doing all that we can to invest in clean energy.
What signals do you think the president has sent with these new appointments about, you know, the future direction of the administration on the environment and on clean air?
Well, what we're hoping for is that these appointees will advance the president's commitment on climate change. The good news here is that the president has an enormous amount of authority in the executive branch to turn away from dirty fossil fuels and to go all in on clean energy. The president has the ability to reject Keystone XL, the tar sands pipeline. He has the ability to make sure we're not drilling in the Arctic or expanding drilling on our public lands, and instead to invest in energy efficiency, holding polluters accountable, and clean energy that will put more people to work. So the appointment of Gina McCarthy to run EPA, the appointment of Ernest Moniz to run the Department of Energy could advance those goals in a significant way.
And have you met McCarthy before? I mean, what do you think she's specifically going to bring to the EPA?
Yes, I've spent a bunch of time with Gina over the last few years. She is a very tough-talking, blunt, candid and passionate woman who has done a great deal over the course of her career in Connecticut, up in Massachusetts, and then over the last 4 years at EPA. She was the person who oversaw the mercury rule, which did so much for curbing the toxic mercury pollution that affects children all across the country, and helped to put in place a number of safeguards to protect our air and water. The biggest thing that she'll be doing over the next couple of years is moving forward on curbing carbon pollution from smokestacks and refineries, so that our fleet of old, outdated fossil fuel facilities can be brought up to more modern standards.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Just that we have great momentum in the United States right now in terms of climate activism. We are seeing a resurgence of activism, particularly at the local level, as people are taking action on fracking or against local coal plants. But I would say the thing that's most inspiring to me is the growth we're seeing in creative activism and advocacy for clean energy. We are no longer a movement that solely focuses on the things that we don't want, but we are increasingly determined to create the world that we want to live in a world and an economy that's based on clean and renewable energy resources. So it gives me a lot of hope for the future.
Well, thanks so much. You've been listening to Michael Bruhn, the Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Joining us now is Marianne Hitt, the Director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to talk with you today, Marianne, because I know that the Beyond Coal campaign recently hit some pretty important milestones, one of which is that a sixth of the coal-fired power plants in the U.S. are now scheduled for retirement. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, the very exciting news is that we have reached the halfway point in our goal of retiring a third of the U.S. coal plants, winning those retirements by 2015 and getting those plants retired by 2020. Those plants are our single biggest source of the carbon pollution that is threatening our climate, and so it's very good news for climate change, but also for public health, because those coal plants are also putting out dangerous substances like mercury and sulfur.
Now, when you talk about retiring the coal plants, they don't just turn off overnight. It's a planned thing. So tell us a little bit more about what's meant by retirement.
Well, we have over 500 coal plants in this country, and many of them are outdated and ready to be retired. And so the utilities that operate them are facing decisions right now about whether to spend literally $1 billion or more per plant updating them, or to just retire them and instead invest that $1 billion in cleaner sources of energy. So oftentimes the way that these things unfold is that we win a agreement with the utility to retire the coal plant 3, 5, 10 years out so that they can start making an orderly transition to a cleaner source of energy, and so that they can take care of the workers in that plant.
So what is the total number of plants that the campaign has helped to get these retirement commitments from?
With our big announcement that we've reached the halfway point in our campaign goal, we have 142 coal plants around the country now committed for retirement. That's out of about 520 nationwide as of 2010.
So 142 coal plants scheduled to be retired. We're also saying that it's about a sixth of the power of the coal power in the U.S. Is that because the size of those plants is significant enough to comprise a sixth of the power?
Believe it or not, we were getting half of our electricity from coal about 5 years ago, and we are now getting just 37% of our electricity from coal in the country. That is because of the great work of the Sierra Club and many allied organizations around the country who have been putting pressure on utilities to retire these dinosaur coal plants and move on to cleaner sources of energy. And not only have we seen this reduction in our use of coal, but we've seen great increases in the amount of wind and solar that are on the grid, which was a very exciting trend.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. I think some people hear about coal plants shutting down or retiring, and then they start to think, well, what does that mean for where we'll get our power? I think it's been very clear from what's happened so far that indeed the lights are staying on. And how is that happening? And what are some of the changes in the clean energy sphere that are making this possible?
Well, one exciting development, in 2012, the number one source of new energy on the grid was wind power. And that is very exciting for a couple of reasons, because it's a clean source of power, because it provides lots of jobs, And because the more wind that comes online, the cheaper that wind power gets for all of us. We also, over the past 4 years, have seen a five-fold increase in solar power. And I know I have solar panels on my roof, and while it still makes up a small percentage of our national energy mix, it is growing by leaps and bounds, and again, the price is coming way down for consumers.
What do you think most people would be surprised to hear about clean energy in the U.S. right now?
I think a lot of times people think of clean energy as something that is a future energy source, something that maybe we'll rely on, you know, 10, 20, 50 years down the road, and most people, I think, would be surprised to know just how much clean energy we are using. That clean energy is a energy source of the present, not of the future. Over 10 states are getting 10% or more of their electricity from wind, and a couple of states are getting over 20% of their electricity from wind. So those trends are only going to increase. We've got many, many more wind and solar projects in the queue. And I think, again, more people are having their homes and businesses powered by wind and solar today than they realize.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
One of the important things to note about all of these victories in retiring these coal plants is those are not only big victories for our climate, because these coal plants are the single biggest source of the carbon pollution that's disrupting our climate, but they are big victories for local public health. And so there are a lot of kids that are breathing easier because they don't have a polluting coal plant in their neighborhood. There are a lot of moms who perhaps are breathing a sigh of relief because they can worry a little bit less about mercury in their fish that was coming down from the smokestacks of these coal plants. So in addition to the benefits for our climate, there are big benefits for public health too. And as Mayor Bloomberg said in the press conference where we announced we hit this milestone, there are literally thousands of lives being saved and billions of dollars in health care costs being saved every year because of these coal plant retirements.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Marianne Hitt, the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Joining us now in our studio is Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Annie, today we're going to talk about what people can find in their local farmers markets and make at home that's also really healthy, nutritious, and delicious. So what do you recommend right now?
Well, I'm calling this the super salad. So this is quinoa, kale, and roasted butternut squash.
Now, these recipes, I should say, might sound intimidating to some folks who've never cooked with quinoa or kale or butternut squash. So what should people be looking for when they buy those ingredients?
Well, let's see. In terms of quinoa, just, you know, quinoa is so widely available now. So just purchase that in your grocery store or wherever you like to buy your quinoa. And if you've been afraid to cook quinoa and have been curious about it, it's actually really, really easy to cook. The most important thing to do with the quinoa is give it a good rinse. We give it two or three rinses. What happens when you rinse it is you remove a coating, which is a protective coating, to protect the quinoa from birds and insects, which has a bitter flavor. So you want to give that maybe three good rinses. And then we cook our quinoa in, like, if you've got a half a cup of quinoa or a cup of quinoa, just equal parts water with a little pinch of salt. Bring your water to a boil in a small pan that has a lid. Add a pinch of salt. Add your quinoa. Let it return to a boil. And then turn it to a very, very low simmer. You're going to cook, it depends upon how much you're cooking, but it's really pretty brief. It might be somewhere between 12 and 15 minutes. You can also, if it's just to the point where it's almost cooked but seems still a little bit chewy, you can just remove it from the stove top, leave the lid on, and let it steam a little bit. Leave it there for 5 to 10 minutes, and it'll be tender when you need it. So you've got your quinoa. Then with butternut squash, I would recommend butternut squash because it's really easy to use. It's user-friendly because it's quick and easy to peel. So peel the squash. I would say maybe cut up, dice up maybe half-inch size cubes of squash. Roast, toss those with olive oil, a little salt and pepper. Roast at 400 degrees, uncovered, until tender. That will take you, again, around 15 minutes, maybe a little more, maybe a little bit less. Let those cool. And then you've got that. Kale, just slice it up into, remove the big rib, whatever variety of kale you're using. Slice it up into thin ribbons. You might want to cut the ribbons across lengthwise so they're not too long. Set those aside so you've got all your basic ingredients. And then You've got your cooled quinoa, you have your cooled squash, you have your raw kale. Toss that all together with olive oil, whatever you like to use, maybe a sherry vinegar or a red wine vinegar or a white vinegar, whatever it is that you like there. It could also be lemon juice. And toss that together with your olive oil, your acidic ingredient, salt and pepper. See how it tastes. Might need a little bit more. Might let it sit for a little bit. Adjust the seasoning before serving. You can toss in a little bit of like fresh parsley or any fresh herb that you like. And I would also recommend maybe a nut, like if you want to make it a little complicated, like a pine nuts or walnuts or even pumpkin seeds. And it's a really nice salad and holds well. You can make it a few hours ahead of time, and it's actually really delicious the next day and the day after, too.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Thanks for listening today to Sierra Club Radio. We wanted to let you know we love hearing from our listeners, so please contact us through our website at sierraclubradio.org. We love hearing your story ideas, your feedback, or your questions for Mr. Green.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking would like to invite you to our 5th Annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Student and Culinary Arts Center on the campus of Henry Ford Community College. We'll have an impressive array of vendors, readers, and body workers for you to choose from. Live music and a fascinating roster of speakers will be included in the admission price of only $5. As an added bonus, all high school and college students with current identification will be admitted free. That's the Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair, Saturday, March 23rd at Henry Ford Community College. Hope to see you there at the fair.
Kids will spend 20 minutes listening to songs like this.
What's your favorite color? What's your...
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth?
Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes twice a day. Stay at the time. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Brian Vander Ark, and you're listening to my music on WHFR Dearborn.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
Jitterbugs. Monday, 1 till 4 p.m. is swing time. I'm Mr. White, your guide to a vintage vibe. Listen to The Swing Time, Monday, 1 till 4 p.m. It's where swing is a thing and jive is alive.
Boogie!
You hear the rhythm romping.
Boogie!
You see the drummer stomping. Drum boogie.
Drill, baby, drill. But on Mars, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover, is now a fully functioning science station. We can say that because the last of MSL's amazing set of tools has now been put to use. We'll talk about the complex sampling system, including the first real drill on Mars, with Luther Beagle of the Jet Propulsion Lab, which built and operates the big rover. Later we'll talk craters and dead astronomers with Bruce Betts, and we'll give you another chance to win Bill Nye the Science Guy's voice on your answering system. In leadoff position is the Planetary Society senior editor and popular blogger Emily Lakdawalla. But even before that, this reminder that I'm probably in Chile's Atacama Desert as you hear this. You can follow my visit to ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, in my Atacama Diary, where I'm chronicling this trip to the driest spot on Earth, 5,000 meters or 16,500 feet above sea level. Pictures and sound are there as well. It's all in my blog at planetary.org. Emily, welcome back. This is an especially interesting topic, I think, that we have today. It's focused on a post that you got up on the blog on the 6th of March. The planetary science in this is fascinating, but it's actually, I think, secondary to the topic you really wanted to talk about.
Yeah, that's right. As this conversation was unfolding over Twitter, it just made me grateful again for the new medium of Twitter for discussing all kinds of great ideas and having random people suddenly participate in an exciting discussion. What happened here is that I posted a link to a blog entry about this comet at Mars in which I'd wondered if the comet might bring a meteor shower to Mars. And the answer to that is probably not, but we can only hope. But there's another scientist on Twitter who said, you know, I wondered if there was a chance that there could be meteor showers at Titan. And that ignited this conversation among several planetary scientists, as well as several bystanders. There is a graduate student in linguistics. There's a retired orbital mechanics guy. There's other random people who I don't even know what they are in real life, but they're all participating in this fascinating overlapping conversation about whether there might be meteors and what they might look like and what Titanian life might see if they were looking up in the sky to see these meteors. It was just a great conversation. And I posted it on the blog as an example of why Twitter is so much more than people posting photos of their breakfast.
So your feelings about Twitter have certainly evolved, and this only makes me feel more guilty that I don't follow it more closely, so maybe it will have a positive influence on me as well. But the entire thread is there. As I said, it's a March 6 entry in Emily's blog at planetary.org. And would you please just say something about the conclusion? If a meteor came down through the Titan atmosphere, would humans see it?
The answer is likely not, because Titan's atmosphere is so thick, and also because the orbital velocity of things out at that distance from the sun is so slow that anything would actually burn up toward the top of the atmosphere. So ironically, they'd be more visible from above than they would be from below.
Ah, but a Titanian whose eyes would have probably evolved to see infrared. Oh, we'll leave it at that. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt.
It's all in the blog. She is a senior editor for the Planetary Society and our Twittering planetary evangelist and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. That's Emily Lakdawalla. Bill Nye is away this week, still on the road, so we're going to jump directly to a conversation that has come up with Emily as well, with Luther Beagle, one of the scientists who works with Curiosity's ability to drill into rocks and collect samples, as it has just done for the first time. We were all thrilled beyond measure when Curiosity touched down on Mars. We marveled at its first images of the red planet's surface. We oohed and awed when it started zapping rocks with its ChemCam laser. So what's the big deal when it starts to drill into rocks? only that this is yet another first for Mars exploration, that it means the first Martian soil has been delivered to the most sophisticated analysis instruments ever to reach that planet, and that we will soon begin to learn if the ancient surface was capable of sustaining life. That's all. Luther Beagle has waited years for this moment. He's a research scientist and group supervisor at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory near Pasadena, California. And he's also a sampling system scientist for Curiosity, tasked with making sure this intricate collection system does what it came for without damaging the rover. Luther dropped by the Planetary Society HQ a few days ago to tell us how things are going. Luther, thanks very much for stopping by the Planetary Society for this little update on Curiosity.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You know, we're here primarily to talk about what I believe may be the greatest physical accomplishment by Curiosity since those 7 minutes of terror that got it down onto the surface. But before we do that, what is the current status of the rover? I mean, I think almost all of our audience knows that there was a scary moment or two a little while ago.
There was. One of the computer systems, we have two computer systems. It's dual string. They're fully redundant. The first one we were using, the RCEA, had a little bit of an issue. We quickly identified it, members of the team, and we've started using the RCEB, and we're going through testing to get everything up and running. And then once that's accomplished, we're going to try to turn RCEA back on to find out what happened.
We're speaking on March 5th. So by the time people hear this, probably much more will be known, and we'll try and report that. Or people should watch for Emily Lakdawalla's blog, where she is following this, of course. Any idea yet what may have happened? Is this one of those wonderful random cosmic ray hits?
I do not know. I've been in the Mojave for 4 days, so I've been kind of outside the loop. But the team seems to have gotten at least a hold of what the issue is, and as soon as we turn RCEA back on, we'll find out.
All right. Well, thank goodness for redundancy.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
So congratulations to you and the entire team. You've drilled into a rock for the first time anywhere in the solar system.
Well, now that we've drilled into things before, just not on Mars. The Soviets drilled into Venus. They got about 3 centimeters or so into Venus.
One of the Venera landers,
yes.
I guess. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they actually did some XRD with it. And
What's XRD?
X-ray diffractometry. To identify the mineralogy. They did that back in the 70s. It was a stationary lander. It came down and it operated for, I think it was an hour. Got a sample, and that's what it did. We've done a little bit of this on the moon, too, both the Russians and the United States back when we were racing around on the moon. So we've done some drilling on the moon. This is the first time we've done it on Mars on a robotic platform.
You know, I did forget that the Apollo astronauts did a little bit of this as well. Just the same, first time on Mars, and quite different from what we've seen in the past, which was scraping or abrading. I mean, you really got to dig in. How far down does this drill go?
Drill itself gets into about 6.5 centimeters. We actually collect samples from about 3 to 5 centimeters. So the way the drill works is, we pound the rocks. It's a rotary percussive drill, like a Bosch drill you can get at Home Depot. It does both hammering and rotation. We create fines with that, and the fines get sucked up the middle of the drill. The majority of them come in from about the 3 to 5 centimeter range.
I hope that people will take a look at the website. We'll put links up at planetary.org/radio, and then the page where this show is located. They really have to see the gyrations, the dance, the cosmic dance that this arm goes through, not just in the drilling process, but everything that follows, including doing this little shake, rattle, and roll to knock off excess.
So what we've been doing for the first drill sample is we're using it to clean. We did the same thing at Rock Nest when we did the scooping. We're trying to get rid of all the terrestrial contamination. And so at Rock Nest, when we scooped up soil samples, the first 3 times we did this, we just dumped the soil samples overboard, used it to clean up any residual organics that were left there because of the assembly process in Florida. We're doing the same thing with the drill. So a lot of what you see on the website, I think, is extra movements that required to get sample everywhere inside the drill bit assembly, or DBA. Once we are sure we're clean, then we clean up that a little bit. It doesn't do as much of that, but it still does a lot because of the sample movement chain is quite complex. on how we have to move the sample around from the drill into the final destination inside the instruments.
People need to see the CAD model mm-hmm. to see the path that these samples go through once they've been picked up by the drill. What is actually moving these soil or regolith samples through all those little tubes to get them where they need to go?
Martian gravity and well-placed arm movements to move everything the way you want it to move. One of the reasons why we do all of this is that one of the instruments, the Kemin XRD instrument, X-ray diffractometer, it requires samples to be less than 150 microns. So we have a sieve inside the arm, and we have to move that material around. We like to look at the material before it goes through the sieve to find out how much material we actually drilled. We don't have a scale on board. Then we put it through the sieve, and we like to look at it again, and then we dump it to either Kemin or the SAM, the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer instrument.
So this sieve, which we should talk a little bit more about, mm-hmm. not that different from when I took my daughters to the beach and they had their little screen device and they'd shake it and all the fine pieces of sand would come out of the bottom. But this sieve, based on some tests done back here at home, I guess you're having to be careful with this now.
Well, there's two sieves, actually. There's a 1-millimeter sieve that, specifically for the SAM instrument, and there's the 150-micron sieve, which is both for the SAM and the GC instrument. And, you know, during testing, we've tested all of this material. We've tested under Martian ambient conditions. It looked like there was a small issue with the sieve may have been coming out. And to be conservative, because this instrument does have to work for some time, we've reduced the amount of hitting and vibing we've tried to do on the sieve to make sure it lasts longer. We're pretty confident, actually we're very confident, that that nothing like what we saw in the test beds will happen on Mars, but we're just trying to make sure that that's the case.
We'll be back with Luther Beagle and more about Curiosity's drill and the rest of its sampling system in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society, speaking to you from Planet Fest 2012, the celebration of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landing on the surface of Mars. This is taking us our next steps in following the water in the search for life to understand those two deep questions. Where did we come from? And are we alone? This is the most exciting thing that people do. And together, we can advocate for planetary science and, dare I say it, change the world.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. My guest this week is Luther Beagle, one of the thousands of scientists, engineers, and others who are part of the Curiosity mission on Mars. Luther's role for the last 4 years has been sampling system scientist, and it's just in the last month that he has finally seen this complex but elegant system begin to collect the soil of Mars. Even better, it is using its drill to extract samples that have not been exposed to the harsh Martian environment for perhaps billions of years. Luther was telling us before the break about concern for one of the sieves that allows only the right size sample particles to reach the internal science instruments. One of the earthbound test beds has suffered a few broken edge welds, welds that hold the vital sieve in place.
And even in the test bed model, where I guess these welds, some of the welds separated, you still were able to, the sieve was still doing its job.
The sieve was still doing its job, yes.
And I bet you guys have just studied, I bet these welds have been studied more than any weld in the history of the space program.
Maybe not, but it's up there. We've studied the whole system, and this is one of the things that we learned from just testing. And we've tested a lot of rocks. We've drilled a lot of rocks. We've drilled a lot of different types of rocks. We've drilled under Martian ambient conditions. We've drilled under Martian pressure and temperature. We've drilled in regular laboratory conditions. We've just tested everything. So when something like this comes up, it's not a surprise.
A couple of weeks ago, Emily Lakdawalla, my colleague here, of course, with the blog, we were just going crazy talking about this gorgeous image of this little scoopful of dirt that I guess was part of the proof that things had gone the way they were supposed to. awfully pretty picture.
It's just amazing. We use that scoop to identify how much material we actually collected from the drill. But when you look at it and you can see the different colors from the material that we have now versus what we saw at Rock Nest, it's just a spectacular image. That all of the cameras on board the spacecraft are just great. I could look at those pictures all day long.
I want to come back to the color of that sample in a moment, but was this really as momentous an accomplishment as I described it up front?
I think so, but that's because I've been working on it for four years off and on. It was really nice, and just to watch it work on another planet is mind-blowing at the very least. It works so well. It just, everything worked the way it should work. The whole process of picking the sample and trying to identify what it was before we put it into the sieve and drill just worked. Everything worked like a charm. And seeing those pictures, I saw them at JPL at like 11 o'clock at night. It was just unbelievable. It was just so great to see. It just makes all the work worthwhile when you see something like that.
So where are we now? Where has that sample material gone?
For right now, we've delivered sample to both SAM and Kemen, and they have done a preliminary analysis, which I think is going to be the result of a press conference next week, or this week, depending on when you're listening to this. And when the computer malfunctioned, we're about to deliver more sample. So one of the things we like to do is there's a lot of knobs and turns and twists you can do with these instruments because they're very, very well put together. We want to look at different aspects of the sample. So we're going to deliver more sample to both Kemen and SAM as soon as the computer's up and running again.
So that beautiful gray, at least in the picture to me, looked almost greenish gray dust. Mm-hmm. Quite different, as you've already implied, from the surface color, and that must be making the soil scientists very excited.
Everybody was excited when they saw what that material looked like and realized that, wow, we're in a place that this material has not been on the surface for billions of years. It's great. It's not oxidized. It's not rusted out like the surface material. It looks pristine, and we're just really excited to get the analysis of what it is down.
So what is ahead, not just in the next week or two, but over the, let's hope, even more than two-year mission of this rover?
So right now, once the computers come back on, like I said, we'll deliver a sample to both SAM and Kemen again, get the confirmation analysis of that. There's a talk of drilling another hole inside Yellowknife Bay where we are now. The science team is weighing the pros and cons for this. We have conjunction coming up in April, which means the Mars is on the other side of the sun, and the team gets to stand down for a little bit and catch our breath, which will be really nice, and work on the scientific papers that we've all been wanting to write. After that, then we're going to head off to Mount Sharp, and that's going to be a long trek, but it'll be well worth it once we get there. We may stop and do some science along the way, depending on what we see. But the ultimate destination of this rover is Mount Sharp. And we'll get there hopefully soon and do some really great science there as well.
Nice work, Luther. Congratulations once again to you, the team that has been dealing with this soil sampling system, including the drill, and of course to everybody else who is behind that amazing machine on Mars.
Yeah, it's amazing how many people have worked on this over the years, and there's just, you can't thank enough people. The people that make everybody like me look good, it's really nice.
That's Luther Beagle. He is a research scientist and group supervisor at JPL, and for the purposes of this conversation, he is specifically one of the sampling system scientists for Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover, which is now a fully operational science station on the surface of the Red Planet. We'll be right back with Bruce Betts for this week's edition of What's Up in just a few moments. Bruce,
in the
out there?
Yeah,
all right.
Now.
I'm diving for the shelter.
So, Matt, are you taking your raincoat to the Atacama?
I don't
well,
know.
That's a
Do
good
I need
idea,
it?
But you don't often need a raincoat in the Atacama, which hosts many an observatory in one of the driest places on Earth. The ALMA site you were at averages about 100 millimeters or about 3.9 inches of rain annually. So you could get it, but you'd have to be unlucky.
That's actually more than I expected in the driest place on Earth.
I don't know the details of that. But yeah, it's got several things that contribute to being dry, which is, of course, one of the reasons that being really high up, why they love it for things like submillimeter observatories. But you have rain shadows created by the Andes and the Chilean coastal range, the inversion from the Humboldt Current off the coast of Chile, and, of course, dry air descending between the Hadley Cell and the Farrell Cell, which is forming the South Pacific High.
I will watch for all of those.
Please do. Okay, we move on, but we'll come back because I'm excited about you hanging out in Chile.
Thank you.
But in the meantime, I asked you on what two planetary bodies does the Polish astronomer Copernicus, born in 1473, have craters named after him? How'd we do, Matt?
We got such fun answers. I wish I could share more of them, but I'll have a couple to tell you about after we talk about some of the straight answers here, including our winner chosen by random.org. It was Steve Lehman, longtime listener and enterer, but I believe a first-time winner in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I happen to know he is the leader or the director of the municipal band and a member of the Astronomical Society in that town where the University of Virginia is based, my father's alma mater, go Cavaliers. Steve said the moon and Mars are where those craters are.
They are indeed. You don't have too many people that have craters on two bodies named after them.
Not bad. And some other people pointed out, a couple of folks, that he also has an asteroid, asteroid 1322 Copernicus, discovered in 1934. One of those people who told us was David Kaplan. Steve, we're going to send you another Revenge T-shirt, that terrific T-shirt from Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, SMBC, with the dinosaur wreaking his revenge for all of his kind on the asteroids. And it's a terrific shirt, and we thank SMBC for providing that to us. They have all kinds of terrific stuff on their website. Can I give you some of the other stuff here? There's some other really fun stuff.
Please do.
This one is just interesting. Ilya Schwartz, who we get good stuff from all the time, said that Copernicus on the moon, of course, not Mars, was a possible landing site for an Apollo mission, the canceled Apollo 20 mission, if only it had happened. We had at least two people who wanted to point out that there was actually, there were third Copernicus craters, maybe third and fourth. Randy Bottoms said there was a third crater, but it is no longer in existence. You see, Copernicus had an innie. Now, for those who aren't up on that, what may be a purely American idiom, it's his belly button. But I love this one as well from David Springer. He says, coincidentally, my dog, Luna, also has an 800-million-year-old crater on her Earth-facing side. It just struck me as fun.
I enjoy dogs named Luna.
Yes. I know. So what do you got for next time?
You're in Chile at this really high observatory, ALMA, they're dedicating. But, you know, it's not the highest permanent observatory in the world.
It is not?
It is not. It is near it, but it is a distinct separate observatory. What is the highest permanent astronomical observatory, and how high is it? Permanent, you know, being a loose term, as opposed to someone hauling a telescope up Mount Everest and claiming to be an observatory.
Wait a minute. I think I see it over there on the ridge.
Look up, my friend.
All right. Well, how do they enter?
Go to... someday I'll get the... You know, 10 years of saying the same thing over and over again.
Yep.
Makes it hard. How about go to planetary.org/radio contest?
Nailed it.
Yes.
And you have until the 18th, that'd be Monday, March 18 at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us that answer. All right.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about cans of dry air as dry as Atacama and how weird that is.
Wait a minute, I got mine here too. There it is.
Dueling dry air. That's your theme.
He's Bruce Betts. He blows us away every week here with What's Up. By the way, the contest prize will once again be Bill Nye's voice on our winner's answering system.
One more reminder that you can follow my trip to the dedication of Alma in my Atacama Diary, part of my blog at planetary.org. You'll find it with the other great blogs offered by the Planetary Society, including Emily's. Of course, I'll also present highlights of my South American adventure here on Planetary Radio, which is produced by the Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the high-minded members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies.
WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking would like to invite you to our 5th Annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Student and Culinary Arts Center on the campus of Henry Ford Community College. We'll have an impressive array of vendors, readers, and body workers for you to choose from. Live music and a fascinating roster of speakers will be included in the admission price of only $5. As an added bonus, all high school and college students with current identification will be admitted free. That's the Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair, Saturday, March 23rd at Henry Ford Community College. Hope to see you there at the fair.
Hey, loyal listener, call WHFR at 313-845-9676 or toll free at 1-800.